Hassan reported that the Goyin writes in his Perish on Shir Hashirim in the first Perek that the Torah speaks about how the Luchos Shniyos are given on Yom HaKippurim, and then after Yom HaKippurim, so then the Torah speaks about Baboker, two mornings after the giving of the Luchos Shniyos, so then comes the beginning of the construction of the Mishkan, and then the Hashros Hashchina that happened in the Mishkan ended up being, the Gon says, on the 15th day of Tishrei, which is the day that we observe Sukkot. In other words, this idea that the Mishkan represents a special connection between Klal Yisrael and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that's obvious. But the Mishkan also represents the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going out of his way. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is doing Ritzoy. He's doing something above and beyond what he has to do. He's doing this idea of Hashras HaShechina. He's allowing the Shechina to come into the Mishkan. So that's what Sukkot represents, that the Hashras HaShechina happened in the Mishkan. Memela, that's why we observe Sukkot on the 15th of Tishrei, because that's the day that represents Ritzoy. It could be, says Rabbi Simon, this connects to the halachic idea, which was the major idea that he focused on in the Shir, the idea of Chal Shem Shamayim al HaSukkah. Right? The idea that Sukkah is considered a type of muktzah that is Chal Min HaTorah. What's the pshat? And it could be that this again represents the fact that our Sukkah is supposed to be Mesameal, the Mishkan, and the Chal Shem Shamayim al HaSukkah represents the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu had a Hashras HaShechina on the Mishkan at this point, and that's why we're not allowed to derive benefit from the Mishkan, from the Sukkah, excuse me. That's why you can't derive benefit from the Sukkah. Rabbi Simon then focused on the fact that when it comes to Chal Shem Shamayim al HaSukkah, so there is a large machlokas between the Taz and the Oneg Yontiv. The Taz says that the din of Chal Shem Shamayim al HaSukkah is only on the only when you are mechaser the sukkah. It's only when you're mechaser the sukkah. Only if you're taking something away, only then do you say that there's an iser of muktzah, that there's an iser of Chal Shem Shamayim al HaSukkah. But if you're not mechaser, according to the Taz, there's no problem. The Oneg Yontiv disagrees. And the Oneg Yontiv says that there's a din of Chal Shem Shamayim al HaSukkah even if it is not being mechaser anything. There are two nafkaminas that emerge. One nafkamina is, let's say a person would want to sit in the sukkah during the time that it's raining. Now, lamaisa, you're not supposed to do that. The Yerushalmi says that you're an idiot if you do that. You're nikra hedyot. So you shouldn't be sitting in the sukkah while it's raining. But if you do, are you in violation of the iser of getting hana'ah from the sukkah because kal shem shamayim ala sukkah? So according to the Taz, obviously not, because you're not being mechaser the sukkah anything. The din of Chal Shem Shamayim is only if I take something away from the sukkah. But the Oneg Yontiv wants to say that you would be in violation. Similarly, the Oneg Yontiv suggests that Noshim, women, are not supposed to sit in the sukkah. They're not supposed to sit in the sukkah, and not only are they not supposed to sit in the sukkah, Zok, the Oneg Yontiv, it's also for Noshim to sit in the sukkah. And the reason for that would be because when a woman sits in the sukkah, since she does not get in the mitzvah of yeshiva sukkah, so memela, she's in violation of the iser of being nenev, getting hana'ah from the sukkah, shelo b'makom mitzvah, because of Chal Shem Shamayim al HaSukkah. This is actually an interesting idea. Because one asks the question, you know, when women are mekayim mitzvah sasei shazman grama, do they get a kiyam ha-mitzvah at all or not? The Pashtis, we're always trained in this yeshiva to think that women, when they're mekayim a mitzvah sasei shazman grama, they in fact get a mitzvah. That's why Rav Soloveitchik always said, Noshim make brachos on mitzvah sasei shazman grama. But an Eved maybe doesn't have Kedushas Yisroel and couldn't make a bracha on mitzvah sasei shazman grama. And Goyim certainly don't have any kiyum ha-mitzvah, that's what Rav Soloveitchik once commented, and even though there's a Tshuvas HaRambam that sounds like they do, the Rav said that Tshuvas HaRambam is Lav Shmei Demar Chosim Aleh. It's not really written by the Rambam, it's some sort of forged Tshuva. Now, Lemaisa, we generally assume that women do get some sort of Kiyam HaMitzvah when they sit in the Sukkah. If they get a Kiyam HaMitzvah, obviously there's going to be no problem. They might not have a Chiyuv, but if they sit in the Sukkah and they get a Mitzvah, it's a Kiyam HaMitzvah, so there's no problem for what they're doing. What's wrong? Right? However, according to the Oneg Yontiv, that they're in violation, so you have to say a razzle-dazzle chiddush. You have to say something. I think that's the word that's officially used in this classroom, right? The razzle dazzle chiddush. So you have to say that Nashim, in fact, do not get any sort of kiyum when they are mekayim mitzvah shez mangrama. How do they make a bracha? So it could be that they make a bracha because, listen, we hold that the iser bracha she'ina tzricha is only an iser d'rabbanon. Rabbeinu Tam says that places in Rosh Hashanah, it's only an iser d'rabbanon. So when it comes to an iser d'rabbanon, lasos nachas ruach l'noshim, so Chazal allow noshim to be mekayim mitzvah shez mangrama with a bracha. The Rambam, however, who holds that the iser bracha she'ina tzricha is an iser d'raisa, it's a violation of losisa, so according to the Rambam, so noshim could not make a bracha because we wouldn't permit you to violate a d'raisa for the din of Nachas Ruach L'Noshim. That was the basic focus of Rav Simon's shir. It's kedai to read the Taz Bifnim, because the Taz Bifnim, when he discusses this principle of Chal Shem Shemayim Al Hasukah, the Taz asks a question, and he points out there's a Machlokes HaRishonim. Does the din of Chal Shem Shemayim Al Hasukah, is a Chal only on the Schach of the Sukkah? What about the Defanos of the Sukkah as well? That's a machlokas between the Rush thinks, I should say. It's a machlokas between the Rush and the Rambam. The Rush wants to say that if you read that the Isser on of Chal Shem Shemayim Al Hasukah is only on the Schach, Udaloka HaRambam, then the Rambam says that Atzei Sukkah is Usser based on Chal Shem Shemayim. The Taz wants to say that no, that really there's no machlokas, but Min HaTorah, the din of Chal Shem Shemayim is only on the Schach, and midrabbanon, the din of Chal Shem Shemayim is chal on the Defanos. And then the Taz goes on to say his idea that the din of Chal Shem Shemayim, which is chal on the Defanos, midrabbanon, and chal on the Schach min haTorah, that is only if you're mechaseret. That is all included in the same Taz. Fine. Afterwards, Rabbi Simon made a few other quick halachic points. One point that he made was in terms of taking the shlak off the sukkah, is there a problem of watering the grass? So usually the English books say that you have to be careful that you take the shlak off in a place that the water is going to hit the concrete first and then roll off, because that's a time delay that would be considered grumma. Rav Soloveitchik, of course, would not consider that to be grumma. According to the Rav's Hagdara of grumma, whenever I set up a system that is automatically going to happen, so even if there's a time delay, that's not considered grumma. That's considered koach acher me'urav bo, and that's considered my ma'isa. So it would be the heter to take off the shlak according to Rav Soloveitchik's Hagdara of Grama. So some Svarim point out that the heter is if the grass is completely suffused with water. Once it's a very heavy rain, so, okay, it's completely suffused, you're not adding anything. That's true, it's nice. I mean, Yesh Lodan, the Diak from the Sefer Yerayim is correct, but that's not for now. But the fact is, oftentimes, the grass is not completely suffused. So is there any heter? Is there any heter? So Rav Simon mentioned very quickly Beremiza. He said that if you look, the Maharal Miprag has an interesting chiddush. The Maharal Miprag tells us that the din of psik reishe, which is usur, is only if I do maisa A, and then maisa B inevitably occurs, but maisa B occurs immediately after maisa A. The Maharal of Prague understands that there's no such thing as a psik reishe if maisa B happens at some later time. It's a little bit different than what everyone else is saying. That's a din of grumma. Maharal of Prague is saying that no, that's considered davar she'eino miskaven in this situation. It's a big chiddush of the Maharal of Prague that Rabbi Simon mentioned b'havla. I actually like it, so that's why I said it over. Then Rabbi Simon spoke quickly about canvas sukkahs. There's a discussion, there's a nice tshuva in the back of the packet for Yechav Adas of Chacham Ovadia Yosef about the use of canvas sukkahs on Yontiv. The Chazon Ish assumes that's only a problem if the walls are going to blow more than three tefachim out. Others assume if the walls will blow at all, it's going to be a problem. Rabbi Simon pointed out, which is interesting, is that it could be that these, what do they call them? The machmirim straps that some people have on the sukkah, which are straps within lovod of each other, and that creates some sort of halachic wall. So Rabbi Simon said, maybe it's not going to help so much, because lovod might not help l'chatkila, because it will be a mechitza gerua. The halacha of a real mechitza, the Gemara in Erevin says, it's supposed to be both shesi and erev, both in both directions. If I have a mechitza only goes one way, that could be a mechitza gerua, and mehechatesi and mechitza gerua is going to help l'chatkila v'yisuk. It could be only help b'diavet. The last thing that Rabbi Simon spoke about was the topic of whether the mats are kosher for a schach. right? As Rabbi Simon said, I think historically there were different generations, and like our parents' generation, our grandparents' generation, I think if I'm speaking to you, so people used to make schach from bulrushes. They just cut them down. It's probably forbidden to do that. These are protected wetlands. So you're probably not supposed to be cutting down those bulrushes, but that's what people did. We don't ask kashas on them. Then later on, I remember as a kid, we all used to have bamboo. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, Lamaise, was machmir not to use bamboo as schach because he felt that a bamboo is a keli, because it's it could be makabel. You can make it just a hole and then you use it as a straw. So Rav Aaron Soloveitchik was machmir not to use bamboo. Rav Shechter once mentioned that people had timed this in Rabbi J. Marcus, because Rabbi J. Marcus edited the SOY Guide to the Yomim Tovim in the 1960s here in Yeshiva, and he wrote, like, in the top of the... There's, like, a lot of these books have the top and the bottom. There's, like, the footnotes on the bottom, and there's, like, the main halachas on top. So on the top, he wrote that bamboo is puzzle for schach because it's a keli. And that was, like, a big scandal. Like, whoa, what? Big Wayu Chumra over here, bamboo's puzzle for schach. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik used to say that, Taka, the bamboo is not kosher for schach because it's a keli. I don't think that was accepted. The question about the mats today is, why are these mats made? So again, if the mat is made l'shem schach, gewaldik. If the mat is not made l'shem schach, if the mat is made for lying down on, so then it could be a problem. There's also an issue in terms of what they tie the various pieces of bamboo. These mats are basically small strands of bamboo which are tied together. So if you tie them together with something that itself is kosher for schach min ha-toira, like you use hemp, use natural fibers to tie it together, that's fine. But if you're using a synthetic fiber, so then that could be an issue. So ad kan, Rabbi Simon's shiur about sukkah. Any comments? Okay, let's go on to Rabbi Neuberger's shiur about Hilchos Yom HaKippurim. Now, this shiur, Rabbi Neuberger's shiur, together with a number of the medical shiurim, are very hard to summarize because a lot of the issues in the shiur are medical knowledge, something which I do not have. I never went to medical school. I like was here in yeshiva for the last couple of years. So I don't really have the medical knowledge to summarize it adequately, so you should really try to listen to these shiurim on your own. The big issue that comes up in fasting on Yom Kippur, you have to fast on Yom Kippur. Right. Torah says you have to fast, but what about if you are a pregnant woman? Do you have to fast on Yom Kippur or not? And it says in Shulchan Aruch, Beferish, pregnant women fasting Yom Kippur. Should be nothing to talk about. The thing is that Rabbi Yaakov Yisrael Fisher, Zechron Lovracha, who was one of the Dayanim in the Badatzei the Charedis in Yerushalayim, so he wrote in the Hakdama to the Sefer Pnei Baruch on Bikur Cholam, not the famous Pnei Baruch. The famous Pnei Baruch is on Hilchos Avelos, but he wrote the Hakdama to the Pnei Baruch on Bikur Cholam. If you want to take it out of the library, you're not going to find it. I took it out of the library last week. It's in my office, but you could borrow it. So the Pnei Baruch comments, the Rabbi Yaakov Yisrael Fisher, in the Hakdama to the Pnei Baruch, he writes that he saw Asaros Noshim, Mapilos, Machmas Hatzom. He saw tens of women who miscarried because of the fast, and therefore he recommends that all women, until they arrive at the ninth month, all women should eat L'shi'urim on Yom Kippur. Once a woman's in the ninth month, Rabbi Yaakov Yisrael Fisher says, it's not so much of a concern, right? Even if the fast leads to her going into premature labor, the baby's going to be okay anyway. But before the ninth month, all women should eat l'shi'urim. The Tzitz Eliezer has a tshuva where he gets upset, and Rav Sternbach has a tshuva where he gets upset. First of all, they say, you know, this is a tremendous kula. This is a huge kula. It's unheard of not to fast in Yom Kippur. Second of all, the big issue is that there's really no chola b'faneinu. Generally speaking, we're only make on Yom Kippur once a person, this is the way Rav Sternbach says it, which is very elegant. We usually only make on Yom Kippur if right now I'm a chola. Right now I'm a chola sheyesh bo sakana. That's what you need to be make on Yom Kippur. But on Tisha B'Av, you can be make even someone's a chola sheyesh bo sakana. Shartz almost generally we're make even if there's some sort of mechush. Right, generally, we make on Shart Somos. The Bir Halacha speaks about Chole and Naim in the context of Tainus Esther. So, Lamaisa, we're only Mako usually if you are sick right now. The issue with the pregnant women, they are not sick right now. The concern is that maybe because of the fast, they're going to be weaker and bad things will happen later on. They're going to go into, it's a chashash that maybe it will lead to some sort of illness of the baby, right? We're mechalo Yom Kippur for the baby, just like mechalo Yom Kippur for the mother. But l'maisa, there's no reason right now to be concerned, because right now the woman is perfectly healthy. So to tell her that she doesn't have to fast, that's too big. That's too big of a kula. This is, in some ways, Rav Sternbach is medame this to the famous case of Yisrael Salanter and the cholera epidemic, no? Rav Yisrael Salanter, during this famous cholera epidemic in Yom Kippur, so he told everybody they had to eat on Yom Kippur. The story goes that he went and he made kiddush in shul on Yom Kippur. It's very problematic. We pass that if you have to eat on Yom Kippur, you don't make kiddush. If it's Yom Kippur, Shechalias B'Shabbos, then there's a discussion if you make kiddush. But a regular Yom Kippur, we pass in, there's no chiyuv kiddush whatsoever, so I don't understand that whole story about Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. But the fact is, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter said that people had to eat on Yom Kippur. What was the pshat? People are not sick right now, but he felt that they had to maintain their resistance to the disease because maybe they'll become sick later. And all of the chachamim arguing with Yisrael Salanter, they are basically saying that no, that you need chola b'faneinu. If it's not chola b'faneinu, so then you can't be megal. That's one issue with the psak of Yisrael Yaakov Fisher. It's a halachic issue. There's another halachic issue. Yisrael Yaakov Fisher is basically arguing that yarda chol shel olam, that today people are weaker than they were in the past. That's probably not true. We know that today people are much healthier than they were in the past. Right? We know that certainly in Hilchos Nida, we generally assume that it says in Shulchan Aruch that a woman, when she is nursing, won't have a re'ias nida. It's not true anymore. Bizman has said happens all the time. Our women are healthier. People are much healthier. So lemaisa, it's hard to say that yarda chol shel olam. Moreover, the problem with Rabbi Yisrael Yaakov Fisher's psak is that the studies don't seem to prove him to be correct. The only study that was written about this was a study based on Shari Tzedek Hospital in 1983 that Rabbi Neuberger referenced. And in that study, it said that, you know, women are not really going to go into preterm labor. There was no higher incidence of going into labor in the earlier months because of fasting. It doesn't happen. That's what the study said. It just doesn't happen. How come the doctors tell women not to fast? So the answer is that the doctors are very nervous about malpractice. The doctors are not saying it based on their medical knowledge. And you have to find this out. Rabbi Neuberger had a few interesting lashonos that he used. You have to ask the doctor in a way to try to find out, is this a psak that you give to everybody? It's a psak that you give to everybody. You tell every pregnant woman that she doesn't have to, that she's not allowed to fast. So basically, that psak is worthless. The psak has no basis. You're telling it to everybody. That's not psak for me. It's a psak. If I'm saying that there's something unique in this case, okay, then we could take it seriously. But if it's for everybody, so then basically what you're saying is that you're nervous about your malpractice. And, you know, the doctor later on, you know, if you get involved in the conversation, the doctor would say, do what you want already. Well, make that comment. In other words, the doctor's saying, yeah, there's really no danger involved. There's no danger involved if you fast. Now, of course, you have to be very careful. You have to be very careful because this is only for most women. Women, however, who have a history of having difficulty from a fast. A woman, certainly, who in this pregnancy has had already labor. She's gone into labor, preterm labor, and then they're able to stop it. By the way, the way you stop labor, apparently, is you drink wine. So if you go into labor, they tell pregnant women not to drink wine, but they're called, once you're in labor, though, it's okay. You've gone into labor during this pregnancy, so then Rabbi Neuberger would say, often you don't have to fast. Or a woman who had two episodes of miscarriages in the past, then also she doesn't fast. If a woman begins to show any signs of dehydration, also you don't fast. Now, again, we try to advise the pregnant women to fast on Yom Kippur, but we try to make sure that they don't dehydrate. Zosomer, stay in an air-conditioned room all day. Zosomeris, make sure that before Yom Kippur you drink a lot. Drink a lot of water to prepare yourself so that you're well hydrated. And odds are it's very likely that everything will be okay. But you should also, the Rav has to know very well the signs of dehydration in terms of the amber urine, in terms of just to know to ask, because if there's any signs of dehydration, you tell the person to break the fast right away. Now, bedarach klal, when you break the fast in these situations, the only chashash of preterm labor, it's all drinking, it's not eating, l'maisa. And in many cases, it would be enough if you drink one of these, like Powerade, or one of these high-energy liquids. That's what really should be done. It's interesting that Rabbi Yisrael Yaakov Fisher paskined that women in the ninth month already can fast. Rav Nevensal gives a psak, if I care, it's 1 second. Rav Nevensal says the first 8 months you should fast, and the ninth month you should not fast. Right? Rav Nevensal's psak is fakaret. Rabbi Neuberger pointed out that in the first 2 weeks of the ninth month, the lungs are not fully developed, and that's a dangerous time to have a baby. Fine. Yeah.
When we say she breaks the fast, it's all with
shiurim. Shiurim, yeah. When we talk about breaking the fast, it's all shiurim. Now, what is the shiurim? So the shiurim, bederach klal, we recommend that you use a shot glass for everything. We use a shot glass. We begin with 8 or 9 minutes, and then you move down depending on what the person needs. Rabbi Sabolovsky, I think, pointed out that he doesn't allow. He has a no drinking shul. That's the rule in his shul. But there are shot glasses in the shul for Yom Kippur, because in Yom Kippur you need shot glasses. Yeah.
Is shiurim also in dehydration situations?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear shiurim.
I thought Rabbi Neuberger mentioned that there are certain situations where you don't even do shiurim, where like
Right. There are certain situations. Once it becomes very intense, you mamish enter real labor or something, so then you don't do any shiurim, stuff like that. But in most cases, like shiurim is going to be shayach. Yes. Now, in terms of a menekes, a woman who's nursing, which is the other big shayla that comes up, a nursing woman to fast on Yom Kippur. So the Bir Halacha writes that if there's a chashash that the woman is nursing, and because of the fast she might dry up and not be able to nurse the baby, so then you could maybe break the fast. That's what the Bir Halacha says. You could break the fast in that situation, because it's not pikuach nefesh for the mother. The mother is not sick, but it's pikuach nefesh for the baby, because all the baby is taking is the milk. L'maisa b'zman hazeh, this psak is not to be relied on. Because Bizman has said, even if the baby can't take from the mother, we have formula. And the baby can take formula. Now, if you have a baby that, for whatever the reason, doesn't want to take formula, or more likely, the parents don't want to give the formula to the baby, so sometimes these, again, are issues that require rabbinic expertise in terms of advising the couple that odds are a woman won't dry up from fasting. It's very unlikely she will dry up. Odds are it won't happen. Even if it does happen, so the formulas today are very good. You have to like do a whole spiel over here. There are people who, b'shita, don't want to give formula. But in this situation, I think the chashash of, you know, you could store up enough milk from a few days before. The baby could have milk of Yom Kippur, and then you could, outside you'll be able to nurse after Yom Kippur. So it's really not such an issue. But again, it requires dealing with a lot of sensitivity. The last R that Rabbi Neuberger that mentioned that I'd like to touch upon is the question of the tshuva Maram Shik. Maram Shik mentions in a lot of these tshuvas that when we talk about sakana by pekuach nefesh, so we use a yardstick of echad mini elef, 1 out of 1,000. And we say, even though for a suffik, pekuach nefesh, we're also doiche everything, but if it's a chshash, rachok, ad ma'od, if it's echad mini elef, 1 out of 1,000, so then we're not worried. It happens that today when you look at drug studies, if you'd ever read the small print of the pills that you have, so the small print will say, oh, the incidence rate of this complication, and the incidence rates are much less than Echad Mini Elef, and they're still worried about them. A drug won't be approved today, even if the incidence rates of something going wrong is much less than Echad Mini Elef. So Rabbi Neuberger said that's kedai to be in his lashon ola al shulchan malachim to propose to the Bnei Torah that maybe someone should look into, that maybe today we have to judge the incidence rate of what's considered a sakana by something different than echad minei elef. It's a shaila to look into. We'll talk about this question later on more when we get to, actually maybe we should do it right now, in Rabbi Dr. Reichman's shiur. So he spoke about organ donation. And he spoke about the difference between living organ donation and what's called cadaveric organ donation. And the shayla by living organ donation is a shayla, am I allowed to enter a suffix sakana to save you from a vadai sakana? That's the shayla. Basically, right, living organ donation is blood, is bone marrow, is living organ donation. Today you could give a kidney, you could give a part of a liver, the lobe of the liver, you could give a lung. Right, these are all organs that can be given from a living person. And the shaila is, am I allowed to enter a suffix sakana to save you from a vadei sakana? Right, the Yerushalmi is called by Lagos Maimini that says that you're mechuyev to enter a suffix sakana to save someone from a vadei sakana. The Kesef Mishnah and the Sma already point out that this Yerushalmi just isn't quoted by the poskim. The Yerushalmi is not quoted by the poskim. So what does that mean? So the Sma says, even though the Kesef Mishnah quotes Yerushalmi, but he doesn't quote it in Shulchan Aruch. So the Sma assumes that the Mechaber changed his mind between writing the Kesef Mishnah and writing the Shulchan Aruch. He changed his mind and he felt that you are not supposed to enter a suffix sakana to save somebody from a vadai sakana. I think this is questionable. I once gave a shiur about this, that I think you have to read the Hakdama to Shulchan Aruch and figure out why Rabbi Yosef Kara wrote Shulchan Aruch when he already wrote Beis Yosef. He didn't intend that people should pass in shailos only from Shulchan Aruch. He really intended that you should be passing shailos based on the Beis Yosef. And the Shulchan Aruch he writes is a quick layman, so to speak. The Shulchan Aruch isn't for the Rabbonim. It's, so to speak, for the Balabatim. The Balabatim is supposed to chazer all the dinim once a month. The original prince of Shulchan Aruch were divided up into Lamed Yom. He's supposed to chazer all of Shulchan Aruch once a month to get the basic dinim. But obviously the advanced dinim that you would get from the Beis Yosef. So I'm not convinced that because the Mechaber leaves out a din, even if it's a din that he mentioned the Beis Yosef, that means that he changed his mind and doesn't hold of it. It could be they just felt it wasn't a basic enough din that had to be included in the Balabatim's guide, so to speak. That's my ha'ara. That's not something anyone else says. Fine. So the question, though, about living organ donation, the question that's relevant to this Maram Shik that Rabbi Neuberger mentioned, is the shaila of entering a suffix sakana to save somebody from a vadei sakana. And the Radvaz is a famous tshuva. The case in the Radvaz is that they say, we're going to cut off your arm. Right? They give a guy an option. We'll cut off your arm, or we're going to kill somebody else. So am I mechuyev to do that, to have my arm cut off, to enter a suffix sakana to save somebody else who's going to be killed from a vadai sakana? Am I mechuyev to do that? So the Radvaz basically speaks about percentages. And I think one of the fellows in the shir pointed out that it's not abundantly clear, if you read the Chuvas Radvaz, what the percentages are. But the way Dr. Reichman said it over is that if there's a 50% likelihood that things are going to go bad, that you're going to die from the procedure, chopping off your arm might mean that you'll die in 50% of the cases. So if you do it, you're chassid shaita. Chassid shaita. Don't do it. If, however, there's a very low level of sakana involved, so then you're mechuyev to do it. If it's somewhere in between, right, between Moshe Rabbeinu and Moshe Feinstein, somewhere in that middle area between a very low incidence of sakana and, let's say, 50%, so b'kahai gavna to reshus. It's not a mitzvah, it's not a chiyuv, it's not usur to do it, it's a reshus. In this context is where the Maharam Shik's Echad Mini Elef is usually brought up. Maharam Shik's saying that Echad Mini Elef is considered a suffix sakana, but it's a suffix sakana that's so insignificant that you'd be mechuyev to do it. Right, crossing the street, for example, right, is a suffix sakana. Right, there could be some meshugana who's driving 95 miles an hour and is going to run you down. But I think that's a type of suffix sakana that's toshu beirabim, and the Maram Shik understands that what that means is echad mini elef. So this basically was a summary of Rabbi Neuberger's shir with a little bit of hosafa from Rabbi Dr. Reichman's shir. Any questions?
Again, this last part, he said if it's 50% or more, he's chassid shatev.
Yeah, that's what Dr. Reichman quoted from the Radvaz is saying.
And then when is he mechuyav to give up his arm?
You're mechuyav to give up your arm if the surgery is so safe that there's a very, very low incidence. Let's say it's echad mini elaf, one out of 1,000 chance you're going to die, so then that's practically not a sakana at all. So memela, you are mechuyav to do it. Okay, let's move on to Rabbi Brander's share about IVF and IUI, about in vitro fertilization and intrauterine insemination, mostly reproductive technology. You should know that I have only been a practicing rabbi now for around 3 months, but I have already dealt with probably 5 shilas of IVF in the few months. These are shilas that are very common that you're very likely to get. So you have to know. You have to know just the mitzias of what's going on. There are a lot of important articles that are written, and it's really kedai to just study on the topic. It's kedai to read through the Nishmas Avram and the Encyclopedia for Halacha and Refuah, where they talk about these issues, because these are issues that, you know, Be'ezus Hashem, we shouldn't receive, but Lamaisa, you're very likely to receive anyway. What Rabbi Brander began with was a bit of hashgafa. The hashgafa is HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives people challenges sometimes. The challenge of infertility is very common. 1 out of every 6 couples is going to be infertile. Infertile means that after a year of trying to have a child, they still cannot. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives challenges, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu also wants us to partner with Him, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to try to solve these challenges. In most cases of infertility, well, you shouldn't say most cases, infertility breaks down 40% of the time. It is a male problem infertility, or whatever the correct term is. 40% of the time is attributed to the female, and then the other 20% of the time it is combined. The questions that come up over here is there's a whole list of tests that come up, and obviously in halacha, even though in the secular world they like to test the man very early on in the process, and that's because the test for a man's sperm is very easy. It's very easy to procure sperm, and it's very easy to test it and see if the problem is the man's. But in halacha, procuring sperm involves very serious yisurim of hashchasas zera, which the Zohar is quoted by the Bedek HaBayis saying it's like the worst isser in the Torah. It's a very, very serious isser. So, lemaisa and halacha, we try to advise doing the semen analysis later on in the process, not right at the beginning. And that's something that you have to be aware of. Again, in the New York area, it's less of an issue. Couples who are going for infertility treatment are going to clinics that have dealt with from people in the past. But out of town, you have to really advise people carefully. The question is whether you do Clomid, which is this drug that tries to stimulate the woman to ovulate. Whether you do Clomid before you do semen analysis or after semen analysis, that's a serious shaila that you should talk about with Rabbonim when it comes up. But these are shailas that come. The other issue that comes up again, and in the New York area, this issue often is taken care of. Many of the clinics deal with from people, but the question of hashgacha, the question that, you know, there are many cases in the news that they impregnated a woman with the sperm of some other man. And therefore, the poskim, they quote that Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach never gave a heter for in vitro fertilization without hashgacha. The poskim say that you should have hashgacha when you do an IVF procedure. The hashgacha basically makes sure that the sperm from this man doesn't get mixed up with sperm from any other man, the eggs from this woman doesn't get mixed up with anyone else's gametes, etc. For purposes of tznius, it's better that the mashgiach in this case should be a woman. That is advised by the poskim, etc. Now, there are a whole host of tests that are done in the process of diagnosing infertility. There are tests that are all known by various names. There's HSG, etc. In most cases, or in many cases, though, these tests might do not cause a problem of nidus, Rabbi Brander said, because the dam that comes out from these tests is going to be dam maka. It's going to be dam maka. Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach is quoted in the Nishmas Avraham as saying that, you see, nidus means that the endometrial lining inside a woman's uterus begins to, as Rabbi Brander says, slough off. That's the expression that he uses for nidus. Lamaisa, what happens if blood comes from the endometrial lining because there's a maka there, because there's a little bit of an incision in that lining? Does that render a woman a nida or not? So the Nishma Savram calls from Shlomo Zalman Auerbach that the woman is not a nida in that situation. That dam maka that comes out, even though it is, biologically speaking, the same blood that would come out be'ez nidusa, but it's coming out because of the cut. So b'kahai gavna, the woman is not a nida, Reb Shlomo Zalman is quoted as saying. They point out that this seems to be a steer in the Chazon Ish, whether a woman is a nida. In this case, Reb Shechter has an interesting shita, you should know. Reb Shechter holds that the maka in the makar might not be a nida min ha-Torah, but that has to be treated like a kesem. That's Reb Shechter's shita. This is a very common shayla in many of these tests. Each test you have to know what it is. Some of these tests don't get anywhere near the makar. There's a test called the laparoscopy that they basically go in through the stomach, so that there's nothing to talk about. You can't possibly become a nida. But in tests that they touches the makar, so you have to deal with this shiloh, whether the dam is dam nida. You also have to deal with the shiloh, psichas piha makar, in terms of the instrument that they insert. How large is that instrument, and is that going to be considered psichas piha makar? We generally are machmir that even psichas piha makar mi bachutz is considered psichas piha makar, and that makes a woman a nida. Yeah. Even though there's a makah she'adur shemotzi dam, Rav Shechter still is machmir that the ish is tmeya midrabanon. That's his chiddush, yeah. Usually when I have a makah she'adur shemotzi dam, the case in Shulchan Aruch is that it's a makah that's not in the makar. So the dam isn't dam nidus. Rav Shechter feels that the whole din of ksamim is that you have dam that comes from that area, shelo bahargasha. That's all din of ksamim. That's exactly what's going on over here. There's dam that's coming from the endometrial lining without a hargasha. The dam is coming because of a cut, so therefore it's considered a kesem. It's a very big chiddush. One of the issues that comes up is the question of IUI. Now, IUI is different than IVF. IVF, basically, you are taking the gametes from the woman, taking the gametes from the man, you are putting them together in a petri dish, and the pregnancy happens, or so to speak, begins, fertilization happens out of the body. IUI is a way that you are taking a syringe and you're putting the zera of the man into the woman with a syringe, and the syringe just has the advantage that it skips all of the nooks and crannies in the body, so it could go straight up to the egg. That is called IUI. Very often IUI is done while the woman is still in nida. That is the time in some ways that she's most fertile. She's during Shiva Nikiyam, and that's when you do IUI. The question is, after you do IUI during the Shiva Nikiyam, so do you have to count the days of Poletes Shechva Zera or not? Because L'chaira, right, you should, it won't be Soser the whole thing, but those days are not Ola. So Rabbi Brander says that this was a question that they asked on his test. Rabbi Brander has a smicha from Machon Pua, or they give some certificate for people who learn the halachas and master the halachas of infertility. So he said that one of the questions they asked on his bechina was whether there's a din of poletes, and he felt that there is. Rav Shechter told me, I dealt with the shayla of this fairly recently, Rav Shechter told me that he has a tshuva that Dr. Abraham wrote to him. Dr. Abraham is the author of the Nishmas Avraham. Wrote to Rav Shechter that there is no problem of poleta shechva zera in this case. Because the din of poleta shechva zera, apparently the metzias is, Dr. Abraham says, that once inside the isha, there's the uterus, and then there's the cervix, and there's the outer area called the vagina. The din of poleta shechva zera, apparently, the metzias is that once the zera is inside the uterus, past the cervix, it will never come out. And the din of poletas is only when the zera goes from the cervix out into the vagina. Since in these cases, they inject with the syringe and it goes past the cervix, it goes into the uterus, so there's absolutely no concern of poleta shechva zera. So we have one kula from Rav Shechter, one chumra. Right? One kula and one chumra. Okay, fine. The shayla in these cases of becoming pregnant, shalo al yedei tashmish hamita, is whether there's a kiyum of pruruvu. And this is a classical shayla in poskim that is based on a gemara in Chagiga about nisabra ba'ambati, and there is a machlokes between the base Shmuel and Eben HaEzer and the Taz and Yeredeya about whether there is a kiyum of pruruvu in this case, basically. That is the question. They speak about how Ben Sira was a product of Yirmiyahu Hanavi, right? Because of Nisabra Ba'ambati, and the Shaila is whether there's a kiyum of pruruvu in this case. Rabbi Brander mentions that the tshuva of the Minchas Yitzchak says that Lekuli Alma, though, when you go for IVF or IUI, there would be a kiyum of pruruvu. Because the Minchas Yitzchak argues that the nature of the mitzvah of pruruvu is a hishtadlus, is trying to have bonim. It could be that in the case of Nisabra Ba'ambati, there's no kiyum of pruruvu because you didn't try. You're going to take a bath. It happens that you turn out pregnant. Woo! It just happened, Azai. So that's not a kiyum of pruruvu. But if you're trying, even if the pregnancy is happening outside of the body, and it's mamish, it's very, very difficult. First of all, it's very expensive, but very often medical insurance don't pay for these procedures. It could cost like $20,000 to go for a procedure like this. It's very expensive, it's very time-consuming, it's very difficult. There's a lot of hishtadlus that goes on. It's painful, it's uncomfortable, it's many things. So there's so much hishtadlus that goes on, so it could be that there is going to be a kiyum of pruruvu. Other questions that come up in terms of these types of issues, Rabbi Brander mentioned, let's say there is a child who is born or after the father died. So b'kai gam, the child is born after the father died. If the father dies during the mother's pregnancy, we assume it's the father l'chol davar. The problem is that the Gemara says that Zera has a life of 3 days. Let's say the father dies before the Zera fertilized the egg. B'kai gavna is their posthumous paternity. This is a machlokes between the Keren Ora and the Noda B'Yehuda. Fine. Then there's other shailas, which are even more complicated, right? The definition of paternity is one issue. What's considered a father? The definition of maternity, of what's considered a mother in halacha, in surrogate motherhood, is a very, very complicated shaila. Let's say one woman donates the eggs, and then another woman carries the baby. Is the birth mother the halachic mother, or is the mother who donated the genetic material the halachic mother? Not a pashut shayla at all. Rabbi Yoshev assumes it's a sveika ledina, and you're megayer the child. The difficulty you could sometimes have is if this is done by non-religious people, so you can't really be megayer the child, because ger katan is only because it's a zechus. If the parents are not religious, then the child won't be megayer mitzvahs, so there's no zechus in this situation. So that's a very, very difficult shayla. They bring a raya from Dina, no? The Chazal say that Rachel was pregnant with Dina and Leah was pregnant with Yosef or something, and then there was a tefillah that was made that my sister won't even be ka'achas hashfachos, HaKadosh Baruch Hu made it, that they flipped the babies, right? That Dina went into Leah and Rachel ended up with Yosef. I think Bali HaTaisis and Chumash called this. That's the Canaan cultist. So that's one of the rayas that they bring for this shayla of who is considered the mother. It's a very complicated shayla. These are not makoros that we usually deal with in the halachic context. It's a very, very, very difficult shayla. There's a lot of literature on these questions. Ad kan divrei Rabbi Brander. Anything else to discuss? Any other questions? Rabbi Konigsberg gave the next year, and he spoke about end-of-life issues. When it comes to end-of-life issues, so the first issue seems to be very posh. You know, there's a mitzvah of saving a person. Obviously, the chola himself has a mitzvah to try to save himself, because in gufo brishuso, he's not allowed to allow himself to expire. We assume that we don't own our own bodies. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is in charge of our body. So l'chora should be, Svara would indicate, and the Stipler writes this in one of his letters. The Stipler writes in a letter in Krayin de Igrisa that he always thought that there's a chiyuv to try to keep people alive as much as possible, because we're not the bialim on our bodies. HaKadosh Baruch Hu made us like a shomer on the body for a while, so we can't do anything. We have to try to fight to keep that pikadon as long as possible. That's what Svara would indicate. However, there's a number of Makoros and Chazal that seem to indicate that what is called quality of life matters in Halacha. First of all, the Gemara in Ksubas and Daf Kuf Dalet speaks about how Rabbi Yehuda HaNossi at the end was suffering from this debilitating abdominal condition. He was in a lot of pain. And the Talmidim, and he always was running to the bathroom. He had to take off his phone, put his phone back on. So the Talmidim are davening that Rabbi Yehuda HaNossi is supposed to live. Amsa Debei Rebbe is davening. And Amsa Debei Rebbe isn't just a maid. We learn halachas from Amsa Debei Rebbe. Amsa Debei Rebbe is davening that Shiakufa Yonim Satachtonim, that Rabbi Yehuda HaNossi should die. And what she did is that she threw a pitcher off the roof, and that made a loud noise, and Mimela, the Talmidim, stopped davening, and her tefillos were able to overpower, and that's why Rabbi Yehuda HaNossi was nifter. Ad kan the Gemara in Ksubas Naf Kuf Dalet. Zok the Radin in the Dharma and Daf Mem, that from this Gemara you see that there are times that you're allowed to daven, if a cholas mitzda'er harbeh, his lashon is, if he's in a lot of pain, so you're allowed to daven, or you're mechuyev to daven, sarich, he says, you have to daven for the chola to die. That sounds like the quality of life matters, right? And if a person doesn't really have quality of life, he's in a lot of pain, so you can daven for the person to die. The Yalkut Shimoni says, similarly, that as a case of a chayim shel nivolheim, that certain elderly people said that their lives are disgusting, not worth it. So the etzah was given, don't go to show for 3 days. And this woman, by the way, it was a woman, she didn't go to show for 3 days and she died. Right, it's important to go to show. Right? You don't go to show for 3 days, so the woman died. Again, Chayim Shel Nivolheim seems to imply that quality of life somehow matters. The Gemara in Soitan Daf Mem Vav similarly has another case that we see that quality of life matters. The people in Luz. Luz is a city that the Malach HaMoves wasn't able to be sholeit over there. So in the older people were katsu b'chayehem. They felt that disgusted by their lives, so they'd go outside of town, and then the Malach HaMavis was able to be sholeit, and they would die. Again, we see that quality of life matters. The real halachic makor in this shayla is Yerideya Simin Shin Lamites in the Ramah, where the Ramah paskins that Hasaras Hamoneya is permitted. Right, if there is a wood chopper outside and he's hacking holts and he's making a lot of noise and that is keeping this person from expiring, it's preventing him from dying, so the Ramah says that you're allowed to tell the guy, stop, right? Gnukshain, stop banging the wood and let nature take its course, let the person die. Hasaras Hamoneya is permitted. However, the same Ramah says that it's forbidden to remove a pillow from under the chola. And the shaila is, right, isn't removing the pillow the same type of thing? It's also hasaras hamoneya. The pillow somehow is keeping the chola alive. What's going on? So there seem to be two answers that are given. One answer is the shach. The shach says the reason you can't remove the pillow is because in that situation you are moving the mace. And because you're moving not the mace, so he's a ghost mace. It's a person who's almost a mace. You're moving this person, and moving him is makariv misaso. It's making him closer to death, and that's why it's also according to the Shach. However, the Lavush wants to say that the reason why you're not allowed to move the pillow is because it's like some heebie-jeebie skula that's going on with the notzos, the feathers in the pillow are somehow keeping this person alive, and that's why you can't move the pillow. Okay, So according to the Shach, whenever there's a situation of any activity that involves moving the mace, so that is going to be usar. But the Levush is saying even more than that. Levush is saying that whatever is mekarev the misa somehow, even if it's like this heebie-jeebie thing of the notzos, that's going to be a problem. I don't think Rabbi Konigsberg really fleshed this out, but there should be some nafgaminas in terms of how we deal with other cases. Okay. Lemaisa. The Ramah is the major maramakom here. And the Ramah says that hasaras hamoineya is permitted, but it's usur to do any action that will be makarev the misa. Rav Moshe Feinstein understands that the Ramah, even though he's talking about a goseis, but the principle that the Ramah is giving us is true even someone who's not a goseis. Even someone who's not at the very end of life, it's hard to know exactly what gesisa is. Rav Schechter always says that gesisa means that the process of misa already began. Rav Schechter holds, like in the case of brain death, that it's a suffix. We'll talk about this in a few minutes. There are three evarim shaneshama tluya bahem. There is the brain, the heart, and the liver. Right? So it's a suffix whether death means all three of them die or death means one of them die. Imtim shalemet means all three of them die. Now we understand what gesisa is. Gesisa means the beginning of the process of death, which means that one of them dies. So according to Rav Schechter, a brain-dead person is a goseis rather than being a mace, right? Because halachically, even though the brain is dead, there's no blood flow to the brain, but at the same time, the other Evam Shanashama Tzul Yibahem is still alive, so the male of that person is a goseis. Be as it may, Rav Moshe assumes that the Ramah's principle would be true even by someone who's not a goseis. And the basic yisod of the Ramah is that you're allowed to be mevater on chaye sha'ah, you're allowed to give up temporary life, and temporary life, Rabbi Konigsberg kept on quoting for Rav Moshe, means chaye sha'ah is anything less than a year. So you're allowed to be mevater on chaye sha'ah for if they are going to be chayim of tsar. If it's only chaye sha'ah and it is years of pain, you're allowed to give up on that. This could be based on the principle that the Gemara in Ksuba says, "Hamavazbeis ayavazbeis yosei mechomesh." You're not allowed to spend more than a fifth to be mekayim a mitzvah. If living chaye sha'ah is going to involve a lot of pain, that's spending like more than a fifth. That's a significant outlay. You're spending a lot. You're giving up a lot for this chayesha, so maybe there's no chiyuv because it's like mevazbeis ayivazbeis yosir mechomesh. That's where Rabbi Moshe understood it. Rav Schechter has a piece, I believe, in the Sefer Bikvei Hatzon. Yeah, it's in Rabbi Konigsberg's packet. Rav Schechter's piece is that no, he has a different hagdara. He also assumes that the Ramah is talking about even someone who's not a goseis. Rav Schechter says that the yisod of the Ramah is that the chola himself has a right to be magdir what is considered pekuach nefesh. Every person has a right to determine what is pekuach nefesh and what's not pekuach nefesh. Most people would say that they are willing to give up on their chaye sha'ah to achieve potential chaye olam. That's what we learn from the Arba Mitzoraim, right? That they say, Imar Marinu Navoha Ir, we're going to go to the city, right? Well, maybe they'll kill us on the way, but if we get there, we'll live, right? So most people would be willing to give up on Safik Chaye Sha'ah, on Vadai Chaye Sha'ah for Safik Chaye Nefesh. But we see from there also that we allow the person to make certain decisions. And one of the decisions that we allow them to make is that they say, in this situation, they don't want to do the pekuach nefesh situations because I have a right to say I don't want it. The Tzitz Eliezer, however, takes the opposite approach. The Tzitz Eliezer wants to say that when the Ramah said Hasaras Hamoneya is permitted, the Ramah is only talking about someone who's a goseis. The Ramah is only talking about someone who's a goseis. Even if your life is very difficult, and even if there's a lot of pain, the Tzitz Eliezer says you're mechuyev to fight. You're mechuyev to try to do all of whatever is in your power to stay alive. He has a raya from a Gemara in Sota that you're mechuyev to do this. The only heter is once a person achieves the status of goseis, and we're not really sure when that is. So therefore, you'd be mechuyev to really try to do a lot. Lemaisa, Rabbi Konigsberg, I don't think was machriya on this shaila, whether we hold like the Tzitz Eliezer, you hold like Rav Moshe and Rav Shechter. But I think many poskim in our yeshiva hold like Rav Moshe and Rav Shechter, that there are times, again, when the life would be a real life of tsa'ar, that you're allowed to give up, and you're allowed not to do anything active. Obviously, you're not allowed to actively kill a person, but you're allowed to, with hasaras hamineya, or the like, you're allowed to not treat a person and allow nature to take its course.
Only if it's chayisha.
Only if it's chayisha, which is less than a year, which, again, in most of these end-of-life situations, that's the issue. Now, just as a matter, I guess, of practical rabbinics, they have these forms which are called DNRs and DNIs, do not resuscitate or do not intubate. To intubate is to put a tube in to keep the person breathing and eating. A do not resuscitate form, Rabbi Konigsberg pointed out, might be dangerous to sign, because if the doctors in the hospital, or more likely the nurses, see that form, they're less likely to treat you at all. They're less likely to treat you at all because they'll see a DNR and they'll interpret it as do not treat. So there's one danger involved. There's another type of form that's called a healthcare proxy, which is basically that you are appointing someone else to make all medical decisions for you. That form, you could appoint a rav, you can appoint a posek to make the decisions for you, and then, you know, that is much less dangerous. Now, in end-of-life situations, what are you mechuyev to give the person? So Reb Moshe says that you're mechuyev to give anything that's natural. You're mechuyev to give food and oxygen, but there's no chiyev to give medicines. Medicines are considered not natural. So let's say you have a cancer patient, and the cancer patient develops a case of pneumonia. So you don't have to give medicine to treat the infection. And you can allow, again, the cancer patient is in tremendous pain, you can allow nature to take its course and the person to expire from the pneumonia, not from the cancer. That's what Reb Moshe would say. Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach says the same as Reb Moshe with a little tweak, a little nuance of difference. Reb Shlomo Zalman says that you have to give food and oxygen and what's considered standard medical treatments. Now, of course, it's very hard to be magdir. What standard medical treatments? I remember years ago, Rabbi Neuberger once gave a shiur in contemporary halacha. When I was taking contemporary halacha, he gave this topic. So he understood that what Reb Shlomo Zalman was saying was something like an aspirin or a Tylenol that you're mechuyev to give. And according to Reb Moshe, maybe you're not. What about pneumonia medication? Standard antibiotics? I think Rabbi Neuberger was not convinced that Reb Shlomo Zalman meant that. It's hard to know. It's hard to know. Now, Lamaisa, one other issue that comes up is called the doctrine of double effect. Sometimes I could treat one issue. If a person's in a lot of pain, so one of the more common painkillers that's used is morphine. Morphine is very powerful, but morphine also suppresses your breathing rate. So that is basically I'm treating the pain. But as a result of that, the double effect, it could be that the person will expire from that. Again, many poskim are makel on that. Disconnecting life support is not hasaras hamoneya. We assume that once a person is on life support, it's not like there's some external thing on the outside. It's not like there's a wood chopper on the outside who's keeping the person alive. We assume that that is internal to the person, ki'ilu. That's as if the person himself is breathing through the machine, and we assume that disconnecting life support is real ritzicha, is not hasaras hamineya. Yeah, question? Just please ask loudly so I can hear you. The DNR should be okay because, right, l'chayra, It's not giving food and oxygen. You're not intervening. If a person begins to go into cardiac arrest, you're to try to resuscitate the person, right? There's no chiv to do that.
You're chiv to put in.
You're chiv to put in oxygen. Right. Right. The shiloh that comes up within the Reb Moshe that some of the doctors discuss is that sometimes at the end of life, patients need a higher concentration of oxygen than normal people live. It could be that you could set the machine to the normal person's amount of oxygen, which would also be like a way of saying, oh, I'm giving you oxygen, but I know that this is not enough oxygen for you to live with. So that's a big discussion.
Would anyone matter not putting in a breather?
No one that was mentioned in these shiurim. I don't know. I'm involved in some online discussion on the tradition blog now with Dr. Lawrence Kaplan about these issues. So maybe he'll bring something up. I don't know. Okay.
DNA would not be permitted.
DNA is not forbidden, but it might be a bad idea because the hospital might interpret it as don't treat the person at all.
DNI
do not intubate.
You have to intubate.
Okay. Okay, Ad Kan Rabbi Rabbi Konigsberg share. Let's move on. We have a few more minutes. Rabbi Sabalovsky share. Try to do what we can. Okay, Rabbi Sabalovsky share spoke about Pekuach Nefesh on Shabbos. And Cholesh in Mosakana and Mechosh. He tried to did Kola Terakula Regalachas. So what Rav Sabalovsky mentioned first of all is that when it comes to Yoledes, so everybody holds that Tuchuya not Hutra. Everybody holds it's Beferish in the Gemara that by Yoledes, a woman who is in labor having a baby, so that's a Dovar Shebeteva. And we do the Malacha Al Yedei Yashinui. When it comes to regular pekuach nefesh, though, there's a machlekes mechaber ramah whether we should try to do it al yedei shinui, which is also machlekes Rambam and the Ramban. The Rambam says that pekuach nefesh we do not do al yedei shinui. The Ramban and the Ramah say that we do it al yedei shinui. Again, obviously, if zman is bohol. Right, if it will take a lot of time and there might be some delay and the seconds matter, so then you don't do any shinui. In a situation the time doesn't matter, even though the person's a cholesh yesh bo sakana, so Ashkenazi psak though is that we do a shinui. The Magen Mishnah says a chiddush. He says that a person is a cholesh yesh bo sakana, you're allowed to do kol tzarchei achola, even if it's not treatment that will make the person better. You're still permitted to do it according to the Magen Mishnah. This is according to Reb Velvel, the basis of Reb Chaim's psak, that Reb Chaim never paskened on Yom Kippur that a chole sheyesh bo sakana would eat pachas mikashir. Reb Chaim would always tell them to eat regularly. The Reb Chaim is not really accepted by Morei Hora'ah, but it's good to know. Reb Velvel said that the basis of Reb Chaim is that he felt eating regularly is considered kol tzarchei achola. And once I hold like the Magen Mishnah, that Kol Tzarchei Achola, whatever might be necessary, even though it's not going to help the person directly, but whatever makes the Chola feel a little bit better is permitted. So Hu Hadin, you're allowed to eat a full shear. So Chola Sheyesh Bo Sakana, we paskin Du Aydei Shinoi. Chola Sheyem Bo Sakana, what's permitted over there? Amir Ola Nochri is permitted. Someone is a Chola Sheyem Bo Sakana, and what a Chola Sheyem Bo Sakana is, Rabbi Dr. Apfel, in his shiur, he was marich. He gave, I think, 15 different cases of chol she'en bo sakanas. Maybe we'll talk about some of that a little bit later. But chol she'en bo sakana, amira lenochri is permitted. What can be done al yedei Yisrael? So the simple reading of Shulchan Aruch is that what you can do al yedei Yisrael is an isur d'rabbanan al yedei Yishinui. A Jew can, for a chol she'en bo sakana, do an isur d'rabbanan al yedei Yishinui. Now, Bisabalovsky, however, paskins like the Egle Tal, that the Egle Tal is mekal on doing even an Isidu Eiraisa, Ayyadei Yashinui, for a Cholash Embo Sakona. He says, if you read the Ramban Bifnim, in the Torah Sa'odam, you'll see that the Ramban really holds that way. The last issue that Rabbi Sabalovsky mentioned very quickly is the discussion of mechush, someone who just has an illness, and there's still an issur refuah. Even though a person just has an ailment, doesn't feel well, there's an issur refuah. Even though bizman hazeh, most of us do not grind our own medicine, but even so, we assume that it's a davar shebeminyan. We assume that once there's a gezeira of medicine that was set up, so lamaisa you can't get rid of it. Just to focus a little bit more, you know, on the chola she'im bo sakana issues, just to jump to Dr. Apfel's shiur. So he gave many different cases, cases that we would sometimes think are not even a chola at all. You see a little bit of an infection, or it could be it's a chola she'im bo sakana, even sometimes a chola she'yesh bo sakana. He mentioned the case about this woman, this young woman who had like a little line going up from an infection. So that's the type of infection that's like could possibly be a staph infection that can't be treated with oral antibiotics, that you have to go for intravenous antibiotics. Sometimes it's complicated. What is a chol she'im bo sakana? What is a chol she'yesh bo sakana? Strep throat, right? Is a chol she'yesh bo sakana? Chol she'im bo sakana? It could be a chol she'yesh bo sakana, no? Even though you're not even that uncomfortable, it just hurts you to speak a little bit. I might even think it's just a mechush. But lemaisa, you already have inside of you the siba of a serious infection, that could be a chola she'yesh bo sakana. The big discussion that comes up in the Achronim is the case of a katan. The Achronim always assume that a katan is dino kechola she'ein bo sakana. How old does this katan have to be a chola she'ein bo sakana? Different shiurim are mentioned in the postgim. Some say till the age of 9 or 10, some say till the age of 6, some say till the age of 3. It's unclear. Rav Shechter gives a hagdara. Rav Shechter's hagdara is that whenever you're not functioning normally, then you're considered a chola she'im bo sakana. That's very important. Now, if I don't function the way I usually function, I'm considered a chola she'im bo sakana. Of course, not every question is answered. Dr. Apfel asked, well, what about if I usually on Shabbos afternoon am able to, this is Dr. Apfel in his world, Shabbos afternoon he likes to learn be'iyun. Halavai should be able to open the sefer on the Shabbos afternoon. But Dr. Apfel likes to learn be'iyun Shabbos afternoon. Let's say he's not feeling well, he's a bit of a headache, and he can't learn be'iyun, he can only learn be'kiyus. Is that considered a chola she'im bo sakana? Is that just a mechush? Right? You can't function normally. Your normal way of functioning is that you learn be'iyun, you learn the Reb Chaims. Now you can't learn the Reb Chaims, you can only learn the Tosfos. Right? Is that chol she'im? It's not clear. It's not really clear. Many of these shailas require rabbanim who know medicine and doctors who know halacha, one of the two or both, to try to properly answer. It's really not clear. There are other issues that Dr. Apfel mentioned very quickly in terms of many of these cases involve the possibility of misayeya, giving a shot on Shabbos. Usually we assume that drawing blood on Shabbos is an issur d'oraisa. The Tzitz Eliezer has a big chiddush, like drawing blood might not be d'oraisa, it's a melacha shein tzvicha l'gufa, because you don't really need the blood qua blood, you don't need the blood as blood, but most assume that drawing blood on Shabbos is an issur d'oraisa because you need a little bit of blood to come out to allow you to draw the rest of the blood, or even to give an injection that goes into the vein on Shabbos. Also, you have to draw a teeny bit of blood in order to get into the vein. That also could be a da'iraisa, a subcutaneous injection or a muscular injection is probably not. In a situation that's an issur da'iraisa, if it's an intravenous injection, or they're drawing blood from you, am I also violating the issur because I'm misayeya, because I'm helping out? Right? The doctor, if I keep my arm like this, the doctor can't draw blood from me, right? I have to help out. I have to open and squeeze and do whatever they tell me to do. So is that misayeya that's going to be an isser? So this is, of course, a sugya in Makkos, the Machlokas Rambam and Raivit over there, and the discussion in the Shach and the Taz and Hilchos Nida, the Hadvarim Yiduim, in terms of misayeya and how that applies to other isurim. Any ha'aros? That was quick, right? Okay, let's go. I think these things most people studied in Hilchos Nida, so I'm not so worried. And if you didn't study, so ask your friend who did study in Hilchos Nida, and he'll tell you. We were in the middle of Dr. Reichman's share. We'll get back to Rav Shechter's share in a few minutes. We're in the middle of Dr. Reichman's share. We spoke about living organ donation, how there are 18 people each day in the United States who die waiting for organs. We spoke about living organ donation. We spoke about the level of sakana that sometimes you're mechoyev, sometimes you're not mechoyev, sometimes it's usher, etc. Halacha Lameisa, Rabbi Bleich is quoted as saying that Bizman Hazeh, giving bone marrow, even though it used to be that bone marrow was never a chiv because it was very painful, they'd have to mamish drill a hole in your bone to extract the marrow. But Bizman Hazeh, Rabbi Bleich says, since they could get up bone marrow in a minimally invasive sort of way, so it could be there's a chiv. That's what Rabbi Bleich said. Kidney donations is interesting. In the earlier years, Tzitz Eliezer said it was usher. That's a troop in the 1960s. At that time, the level of medicine wasn't such, and there was a real sakana to get involved in kidney donation. Today, the sakana is... Tzitz Eliezer used to say that it was usher to give a kidney. Today, the sakana is much less. People assume today it's not usher, but it's not really a... of our mitzvah, it's probably some sort of reshus. Rabbi Dr. Reichman showed all of these ads in the Jewish press about people asking for this type of kidney, this type of blood, etc. So again, it could be that we assume that that no poskim today would say it's usher, but there's probably no chiyuv yet. The question of cadaveric donation is really the question of brain death. Giving organs at the end of life. Now, giving organs when a person is brain dead. Brain death is a very new mitzius. Brain death basically means that respiration, breathing, is not happening autonomously. It's not happening on its own. The brain stem is also dead. Brain death is diagnosed through a variety of bedside tests in terms of, like, shooting some air into the ears and shooting the light into the eyes and seeing if there's any sort of response. Some posts can recommend, Reb Shlomo Zalman might recommend this, and Reb Moshe might recommend this, that you also have to do a scan of the brain to see that the brain is beginning to disintegrate in order to properly diagnose brain death. Brain death couldn't exist many years ago because once your brain stopped, so mamela, your heart would stop shortly after. Once your heart would stop, your brain would stop shortly after. Bizman hazeh, so we have this new issue of brain death, and the question is, halachically, what's the status of brain death? It's a Gemara in Yuma has a question about when you are nafla alav mapoles, and you want to try to get to the person, so how do you identify the person still alive? It's a machlekes in the Gemara, whether you go ad nechirav or ad libo, and that machlekes seems to be, what's the hagdara of life? Again, it's not abundantly clear. If you look in the Mishonim in the Sigya over there, it could be that they're only talking about the simin for life, not the siba. It's unclear from that Gemara. Lemaisa, but this is usually the way the conversation begins. There's also the discussion of Gemara in Chulin based on the Mishnah in Ahalos about Hutaz Roshan. Once you are decapitated, that halachically you're considered dead. And then there's also a type of decapitation that the head is technically attached to the body, but it is what we call physiologically decapitated. Zosomeris, that there is no longer blood flow to the head. So that might be Hutaz Roshan, and that might be the Marimakom for death. When there's no blood flow to the brain, in other words, that the brain is not functioning, Reb Moshe is quoted by some as saying that the Hagdara of death is lack of independent respiration, which is what we call brain death. Reb Shechter, we mentioned earlier, says it depends on Yivam Shan Neshama Tluya Behem. Rabbi Bleich says it depends both on the heart and the brain. Reb Shlomo Zalman, in theory, accepts brain death as being dead, but he says that since the person is a goseis, you're not allowed to do the tests to properly diagnose brain death. There are new issues that are coming up today in terms of selling organs, which is becoming very, very common. In secular society, they say that you're not allowed to sell organs. You're only allowed to sell liquid types of organs that regenerate themselves. But a solid organ, I'm not allowed to sell a kidney in secular society. In halacha, it's not clear that you're not allowed to sell a kidney. In hepatase, you're not allowed to. This is a discussion that... Rav Zevin has in his Sefer L'Arah HaHalacha about Mishpat Shylock. He has a discussion about the pound of flesh. Is a pound of flesh considered the bilos of me or not? Do I really own my body? We mentioned earlier the Radvaz. That person is not the bilum on his own body. So it could be that you can't sell it because you don't own it. Alternatively, Rav Zalman Nechemya deals with the question, maybe you can't sell my organs because what Maisa Kinyan is Shayach on my organ? It's an interesting question. Rav Zalman Nechemya entertains that maybe the idea is that there's some sort of Kinyan, like Kinyan of Avodim. Maybe that's what's going on over here. There's a lot of literature. Dr. Reichman ran through this part very, very quickly. Today, there are new areas that are being looked into, transplanting faces, transplanting hands. There are many new issues that are coming up. Let's maybe just very, very quickly go through Rabbi Tendler's shiur, and then we'll get back to Rabbi Schechter's shiur, and we could leave Rabbi Hirsch's shiur for your own edification. Or I gave Chazar shiur and Rabbi Hirsch's shiur a few years ago. Also, you can find it somewhere. I'm sure I gave a Chazar shiur, and then he said the shiur a number of times. Rabbi Tendler spoke about stem cell research. He mentioned first a bit of hashgafa, that the way to come to love HaKadosh Baruch Hu isn't just by learning Shas and Poskim, but it's that you look in the Bria, you look at the world, and then you see the beautiful things that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is able to do. One of these beautiful things is stem cells. Stem cells were really discovered in 1997. They were isolated for the first time. And shortly after, by 2004, they were already doing work with stem cells. Of course, much of this was held up because there was a Dr. Huang, I don't know how you pronounce it, H-W-A-N-G, page 3 in the Rabbi Tendler packet. This guy was a huge farce, Shein Kamohu. Everything he said was fake. He was making up numbers, making up stories. He was getting his lab assistants to produce their own body organs, and he was claiming like research on it. Everything was fake. The one thing he actually did was he actually was successful in cloning a dog who he named Snuppy. But that's neither here nor there. That's the one thing that he did. Lemaisa today, no one is really trying to clone human beings. What people are trying to do is to clone parts of human beings. They were successful in cloning a prostate from prostate stem cells, and that really could be tremendous. It could mamish be tremendous, because if a person has a non-functioning organ and you could inject some of these stem cells and suddenly create a new organ, yeshme ayin, right? That's gevaldik. That's unbelievable. The shaila that comes up, is there a chiyuv to do so? Well, there's a chiyuv to engage in refuah. Even though the Torah speaks about v'rapa yirapa is a reshus, but l'maisa, Shulchan Aruch quotes it as a chiyuv. There's a chiyuv of v'hashei bosolo, a chiyuv to try to do hashavas aveda. And if there's a mitzvah hashavas aveda on the mamon, so then there's a mitzvah hashavas aveda on the guf. And then there's also the din of lo samar adamri echa, which involves even hiring someone to save a person. The shaila about stem cells is most often stem cells are obtained through abortion. Abortion, even though the Catholic Church assumes, is a problem from conception. Halacha, Rabbi Tendler says, treats abortion like ritzicha, yes, but it's only after day 40 that's treated like ritzicha. Before that, it is like wasting seed, which is also usher, but not the same higher level of iser. And Rabbi Tendler finished off with a lot of hashgafa about how the goal should be that halacha and science coexist, not synthesize. When you synthesize items, so you create a new thing that is eino dome to what you had before, when you coexist, so halacha sheds light on science, and science sheds light on halacha, and it's not the pshat, the hafokhta above the kulaba, that you could find stem cells by learning a sugya in Bava Basra. But the pshat is that once you find stem cells in the laboratory, so then you have to go back to the Gemara and see what the Gemara tells you about stem cells, and see what the Gemara tells you about dealing with these. Ad kan all the medical shiurim. Any ha'aris quickly, or should we just begin with Shechter Shir? Okay, let's talk about Yerusha. Okay, the Kollel this year is learning Yesh Nochlem, so I think Rav Shechter gave him more thorough shiur about Yerusha than he's given in the past. The Torah has many rules about Yerusha. There's a whole sequence of who is Yerush first, who's Yerush second, daughters are not Yerush, sons are Yerush. If you don't have daughters and sons, the other relatives, there's a whole pecking order that's mentioned in the Chumash. Very often, the shaila that comes up in our modern society is that people don't want to do Yerusha the way the Torah speaks about doing Yerusha. So what do you do in that case? You want your daughters to get something. So what do you do? So the first etzah that could be is that you could say, Dina de Malchusa Dina, right? This is the easiest one. You could say, well, you know, the law of the land, Halacha recognizes the law of the land, so out Dina de Malchusa, so secular laws should be binding. So this is not true. This is not true for two reasons. One reason is the Poskim say, the Tshuvas HaRashba says it in Choshen Mishpat, and the Maharit says it, that we don't say Dina de Malchusa in an issue between two Jews. We don't say Dina de Malchusa between two Jews. But if we'd say Dina de Malchusa between two Jews, the Rashba says, we'd throw all of Torah in the garbage. Chas v'shalom, no? Why do I need to learn Baba Basra? or just follow Dina de Malchusa, and whatever society decides wins in the fight between the Marikam and the Muchzik, so that's what Paskin wins. Right? You can't do that. You can't do that. That would be terrible. So that's one issue. Right? The case of the Yerusha, we're assuming that both the father and the son are Jewish. Right? So the issue over here, two Jews, you can't say Dina de Malchusa. No Safakach, we can't say Dina de Malchusa, because Dina de Malchusa is a principle that we say in Isser v'Heter. Yerusha is not Isser v'Heter. Dina de Malchusa is a principle that we say in Dina Mamnis. I'm getting tired already. Yerusha is not Dina Mamnis. Yerusha is Isser v'Heter. The Torah says, V'Haisa Zosachem L'chukas Mishpat. The Rambam tells us, we're not clear exactly where there's a Gemara. It could be that there's no Gemara. It's only a Medrash HaGadol. Whatever it is, that the Rambam tells us that Yerusha is called a Chukah. Yerusha is called a Choik, which is Isser v'Heter. It's not governed by the regular rules of Dine Mamnis, in terms of Sfeikis, in terms of the like. Yerusha is Isser v'Heter. It's not Dine Mamnis. It's interesting, by the way, where it appears in Shulchan Aruch, no? Yerusha in Shulchan Aruch does appear in Shulchan Aruch Chosh and Mishpat. So, it's a shtickle kasha on the shtickle Torah within the Rambam. The same shtickle Torah is a discussion they have in Hilchos Ribbis, though. Hilchos Ribbis actually appears in Yerideya. Right? So Hilchos Ribbis, we could say, is not really, even though it's part of Yadin Yadin in Yeshiva, it's not part of regular Smicha, but that's for other reasons. Fine. So, Lamaisa, we want to, we don't want to have the Dina Yerusha that the Torah says, and Dina de Malchusa won't help. So what can we do? So what we can do is the Eitza of Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka in the Mishnah on Kuf Lamed says that a father can be mancho l'cho mi sheyirtzeh, providing A, he does it in the lashon of positive, not a lashon of negative. I say so-and-so should get Yerusha rather than so-and-so should not get Yerusha. That's point A. Point B is that it has to be someone who is ro'oi l'horisho. So in all of these situations, so l'maisa, I am able to use the din of Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. There's another consideration, though. The Gemara has a suffix about whether the din of Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka is only formulated by Yeshchiv Merah. A father says, I want this son to be Yerush. So he says on the positive way, not the negative way. And he speaks it about, I want this son. He doesn't say not that. So he says, this son, positive, not negative. It's someone who's very L'Horisho, should work. But the Gemara says, a suffix, maybe Rabbi Yochanan Broka's din only applies to a Shchiv Merah. If you're not a Shchiv Merah yet, Shchiv Merah means that you're sick. It doesn't mean you're a Goseis. A Goseis means that you already began to die. Shchiv Merah means you're sick. So it could be that the din of Rabbi Yochanan Broka only applies to Shchiv Merah. Oy bazoy, it won't really help us all that much. Moreover, the din of Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka probably won't help if you want to give Yerusha to your wife, no? A wife is not Reilo Horisho. A Baal is Yerusha's Ishto. And Isha ain't a Yerusha's Asbaila. So the din of Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka won't help over there. So it was a nice try. What? A daughter is considered Reilo Horisho because she's Yotze Chalotzav, right? What? I don't remember the sugya so well, but I think we assume ben bein habonim for short works. Bas bein habonim, does it help? I don't remember the sugya so well. I don't know. It's been a while since I've been Yesh Nochum. I don't know. Okay. The way Rav Shechter said it in Shir is that it won't help by a wife. Rav Shechter also spoke very quickly as a Maimer HaMusker about what Pishnayim by Yibachar means. It means that if there are two sons, so I divide the Nachal up into three parts and the Bachar gets two-thirds. The conservative Zeppis have a whole fancy shtickle Torah that this represented some evolution of Halacha, that beforehand it meant something else and then it changed. Rav Shechter went on a little tangent about that. Yes?
I think yesterday Rabbi David Schwartz, and talking to Nicole Al, he mentioned a Shtar Chatzizach.
Yeah, yeah. We'll get there.
So it implied that Rabbi Yochanan Rogan's din doesn't work by Abbas. There has to be some extra shtickle in Allah.
Oh, okay. Right, that could be. Right. In other words, the fact that they had such a thing as Shtar Chatzi Zachar meant they didn't. Or it could be just it wasn't applicable because Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka only helps you passing by a Shkiv Mirah. Right? The Shtar Chatzi Zachar is taco what we use to solve the problem, but will. What does it say?
I haven't learned to give it, but definitely like the Mishnah and the Rashi there are assuming only Ben Ben and Bottom and Bas
and Not Bas, okay.
That's right.
Sanachanami. So it won't help by Bas. Okay, good. Good. So are there other Eitzahs to kind of give Yerusha in a way that's not Toradic, but will still be Chal? Will still be Chal. So there is... There is a discussion in a tshuva that Rabbi Yitzchak Ochanan wrote that maybe the father doesn't have to do anything, just rely on the sons to do it properly. Maybe the mitzvah of Yakir, or the mitzvah of giving out Nachala, isn't the father's mitzvah, it's the mitzvah of the sons take it properly, so the father doesn't do anything, then he dies, and then let the sons deal with it. That's what Yitzchak Ochanan discusses. He points out, well, first of all, there's the Ramban in Sefer HaMitzvos, in the Hashmatos, the Ramban says that the mitzvah of Yakir really is on the father, and the mitzvah is that the father has a chiyuv to give out the Yerusha properly. Moreover, Reb Yitzchak Ochanan wants to say that the father has a chiyuv al afrushe mi isura to make sure that the kids won't be set up in the situation they'll do things wrong. So what can you do? So you write a tzava'a. Write a will. Now, the Rav Shachter quoted that you're supposed to write your will when you're 50 years old. That's what the Sefer Chaim of Bracha Meshmer Shalom says, based on the pasuk Bishnas Hayovel Hazos Teshuva Isha Chazaso. Rav Mordechai Gifter used the pasuk in Strain Hilchas Avesek L'Chaim of Bracha Meshmer Shalom. Fine. Some say that you don't need to write a will at all. Some say that you could do it based on there's a din d'rabbanan of mitzvah l'kayim divrei hames. The din d'rabbanan, yeah. We'll talk about how the tzavah works in a few minutes, right? We haven't said it yet. We know writing a tzavah would help. We'll talk about how. Others say that you don't need any sort of tzavah. All you need is that mitzvah l'kayim divrei hames, which is that once a guy dies, there's a mitzvah to listen to what he said. But the Gemara in Gittin points out this is only true when it's hushlash mitchil l'kach, when there's someone else who's holding on to the item. So if there's a bank account, so I could say mitzvah l'kayim divrei hames, because that's like hushlash mitzchil l'kach. Maybe by tztaki you don't need hushlash mitzchil l'kach, etc. So maybe that could help. But that would only help a money that is in the bank account. Money that's not in the bank account, that's not being held on and signed over. You'd have to like sign it over. It's held by the bank and you'd sign it over for someone else. Money that's not being held that way, this idea of mitzvah l'kayim divrei hames won't help. Rabbi Akiva Eger has a interesting idea. He says that there's no need for tzava'ah at all because the children have a mitzvah of kibud av v'eim, and they have to listen to what the father said. So the father just tells them how to do it, so they're mechuyev to do it based on what daddy said. A few problems, and some gedolei Yisrael Taka didn't write a tzava'ah based on this Rabbi Akiva Eger. A few problems. First of all, who says they'll listen? What about also if you don't have children, if you don't have sons? Reb Moshe had a further chiddush. He says that you don't need a tzava'ah because Reb Moshe says that there are two elements of kinyanim always. There's the gemiras das in the kinyan, and there's the maisa hakinyan. Reb Moshe and the Chazon Ish both assume that when they have complete gemiras das, I don't need a maisa kinyan. Therefore, when I write a will, I have complete gemiras das about how I'm going to distribute my estate. And even though I use a lashon of I bequeath, which sounds like it's happening la'achar misa, but it doesn't really happen la'achar misa. Everybody knows it's happening like sha'achas koidem misa. Everybody knows. So therefore, you don't need any tzava'ah, and all you do is you use a secular will, and there's going to be no problem of anything. There's no problem. Just write a secular will. That's what Moshe said. Lamaisa, not such a good idea. Lamaisa, you should write a will. So how does a will work? So the will works today based on a shtar chatzi zachar. In the time of the Rishonim, they want the daughters to inherit, but not as much as the sons. So every bas we get chatzi zachar. Rav Shlomo Zalman says that bezman hazeh, bas should get the full amount of a zachar. Basically, what you do in this case is you make a kinyan sudder, that you're mechayiv yourself right now that the children will all collect a lot of money, a certain amount of money, you're mechayiv yourself to each child, and the child really owns it right now, but the gaviyah cannot happen until later on. I'm mechayiv myself with a kinyan sudder. Now, usually when I do a kinyan sudder, there should be a problem of kolsa kinyano. I can't do a kinyan sudder that the, right, kolsa kinyano is like in the song Yeshiva Sharei. The mice is over here and the chalos is over there. That's what kolsa kinyano means. That the there's a division between when I'm doing the mice I kinyan and when the chalos of the kinyan is. So usually there would be a problem of kolsa kinyano even by kinyan sudder. But over here, what I'm doing, that I'm mechayiv myself right now, it's me'achshav. So the Gemara in the Durim says that kol me'achshav, there's no problem of kol sekinyano. Memela, basically what I'm doing is I'm being mechayiv myself, I'm creating a chayiv. I'm saying that I owe my children this amount of money. Each child is entitled to this amount of money. They can't collect it right now. They can only collect it later on, right, after I die. But really the chiyuv is going to be sha'achas. I'm chayiv myself right now, and the gaviyah is going to be shayich sha'achas kodem misa. One problem that Rav Shechter had with this is in tax law, this is a problem. There's a different amount of taxes between inheritance tax pays a different amount than gift tax. If it's a chayiv, and I'm really giving my children a gift, so there should be a different amount of taxes that you're mechayiv to pay. That's a problem. Basically, that's how it works, correct? I think this is what Rav Shechter said. It's modeled after the Shtar Chatzi Zohar. It's a hischaivos that I'm making with a kinyan that's going to be chal it's chal me'achshav, but the zechus gevia is not going to be until sha'achas kodem misasi. Yeah.
Rav Shechter, I mean, I think he wasn't discussing writing every single beneficiary.
You make this chayvus way more than what you have.
Not putting who I want, I'm just tying myself to this. So at the end of the day, it's not going to be a gift tax, because the whole point of this chayvus is that the actual halachic inheritors are never going to end up paying this chayvus. They'll fulfill the will.
In other words, you give it to one person, that one person should have a serious gift tax, because that one person is getting is getting all the money as a gift.
His chayvus is only al tanai, that the will, secular will.
Right. So I think Rav Shechter's problem was that legally, though, this is still questionable, because legally,
his chayvus doesn't have to be to every single person.
I mean, you could do it. In the packet, I gave a nusach of a will that Rabbi Willig uses. You'll read Rabbi Willig's Nusach of the Will. Right? Yeah. So you read Rabbi Willig's Nusach of the Will, and he describes one could will his entire estate to one person, like your same example, his wife, and you obligate yourself to pay her a sum of money greater than the total assets, and in such a case, paragraph 2 in the obligation form should be omitted, etc. Right? If you want to include many persons, then the obligation is made. Right? In other words, there are two different versions here in the official will that we give out in this packet. Fine. Okay, it's already late. Yeah.
Can you obligate yourself for a percentage of your assets, or does it have to be a specific thing? Like, if you're 50 years old, you don't know exactly how much you're going to have in 30 years. Like, Rav Shechter kept saying, like, I'm going to give a million to this person.
Yeah, he kept on speaking about fixed amounts.
Yeah.
Can you do a percentage?
That's what you write in the will.
You could write anything you want in the will. Right? I could write, I'm a chayiv myself $9 million in the will. And I die without $9 million. I die with 50 cents. But then there's another will that says how the money that I'm left at the end gets distributed, and that one beneficiary has to listen to the terms of the will. Then I guess you have to prorate it based on what remains.
And you obligate yourself for $9 million and die with
$12 million. No, I obligate myself for more than I really have. More than it's shayach I'm going to have. Right? if I really have $12 million, so then on $3 million, the dinum of Yerusha would set in, and then we have the same problem. Okay, I mean, Rav Shechter at the end basically spoke about questions of Avurei Achsanta by Yerusha. Maybe because it's late, we'll leave it. Should we daven Mincha? Shkayach. I tried, I got tired.
What is the Kenyan suitors?
Kenyan suitors, yeah.
What is
it? It's a handkerchief. Just like when you sell the chametz to the rabbi.
Is that chalitin?
The thing of chalitin is the same thing as suitors, yeah. I mean, the word chalitin is...